All right, everybody, welcome back. Bio Bros episode 14 on all streaming platforms. That means now we have the same amount of episodes on streaming on all streaming platforms as the YouTube exclusives now. That's big one. Just found that out right before the show recording. We went to double check the episodes. But we're going to do Intro to Nepenthes today. So this one's not going to be ultra in-depth. When we do the more in-depth episodes, I want to have a guest or two on here to talk about things because there's some controversial stuff, some things about different opinions, and I want more of that. But this is just going to be more of an introduction and a bit of a care guide as well into that. So let's start off as normal and with all the science stuff and history. So, monotypic family of Nepenthaceae. That means only Nepenthes are in this family at all. The word Nepenthes comes from the Odyssey, the original one from way back in the day, and it translates roughly to a drug that cures all grief. That's kind of interesting. It was actually mentioned in The Mandalorian, I believe. They're talking about Nepenthe as like drink that they would drink, and that basically turned into Nepenthes. The first ever record of these plants was in 1658 in Madagascar. Of course, native people in those areas where Nepenthes are native knew about them, but the first time anybody wrote it down and shared it and had more of a scientific understanding of them rather than just being like, yeah, these plants grow here, was 1658. And then a bunch of nonsense occurred during between 1658 and 1869 when Nepenthes officially became a genus. There were a couple other names that they had gone by. A couple other people had discovered them independently, and Nepenthes is what it got settled on in 1869, that was. These plants, they are native to the old world tropics, like southern China, Indonesia, Philippines, a couple in Madagascar, a couple in Australia. Northern Australia is very, very tip. And most of them are in Borneo and Sumatra. So you're going to find pretty much all of them, usually vines or epiphytes, a couple lithophytes in there, a couple things that sprawl around on the ground, but generally it's a vine. Usually they'll have an upper and a lower pitcher on them. They're different depending on the life stage of the plant and how the plant's growing. Upper literally means upper, higher up when they're growing. And things like Nepenthes rafflesiana, their pitchers are completely different from upper to lower, and they target different prey items. So very cool. And let's see, one more point for us before we leave here. And a good few of them actually have symbiotic relationships with different animals. It's super cool. So, Nepenthes lowii, for instance, has a symbiotic relationship with tree shrews. They're like the equivalent of squirrels over where they're from, where they're shaped like a toilet. Coincidentally, they're not the Nepenthes species that's named after a toilet. They're shaped kind of like a toilet, and they have this white sugar stuff on the lid. And the tree shrew climbs in and starts eating that sugar. That sugar has a laxative in it, and the tree shrew poops into the plant and fertilizes it that way. So very interesting, super cool. Nepenthes ampullaria has a symbiotic relationship with a few different animals, really. My favorite example is a frog that breeds and lives near exclusively in Nepenthes ampullaria called Microhyla nepenthicola. Very, very cool. Fairly recent discovery as well. Awesome stuff. Nepenthes bicolicarda has symbiotic relationships with ants that help them do a bunch of stuff. Really cool, lots of different ones. That's just looking into those specifically for more details if you're into that. Big fan. So that's it for a bit of basics, not basics, but quick overview of the plants. You should have a fair idea of what they are, and I just was assuming that if you clicked on this, you were familiar with the word Nepenthes.
Yeah, that's a lot of information that I had no idea, because Shaw is definitely the person who knows everything about Nepenthes compared to me. I know nothing. So you won't hear much about them from me this episode, other than questions.
Yeah, which is Exactly what kind of the plan was. Depend, these are my jam, into them a lot. I research them for fun, and they're very, very cool plants. Another thing I forgot to mention was Highland versus Lowland. You'll hear that a lot, and intermediate. It's the reason nobody has a solid answer for that is because there isn't a solid answer. You look up all these care guides and stuff, and you're like, well, what does Highland even mean? And it's like, dude, Highlands can mean anything from it's a little cool to nearly freezing. There are some that are considered alpine tropical, where they nearly freeze almost every night. And there's all the way down to the opposite end of the spectrum is something like Nepenthes ampullaria or bicolicarda, that they get up into the 90s regularly. And they're just these hot, ultra-humid swamps to, like I said, alpine tropical, and everything in between. And these species can be very variable. They can be found, Nepenthes vichii is a very, very, very popular plant, probably the most popular Nepenthes. And they can be highland to lowland to anywhere in between. And cultivation, again, not the wild, so it's very weird. Just in general, highland, give them a big shift in temperature. Make it drop as much as you can at night. And then lowland, keep it hot. Most of lowland will deal with highland, but a lot of highland won't deal with lowland conditions. It's a bit of a disaster as far as that goes. Like I said, the reason you can't get a clear answer is because there isn't one. But Alex, do you have any questions about Nepenthes? What do people who are familiar with plants, they like stuff, what are they wondering about?
Someone who's like not fully familiar with them, like someone who knows. I wouldn't say I'm not like. I'm stumbling over my own words. No, I know a little bit about them. So, like, from my perspective, I guess real questions would be things like, what would be a good one for keeping at home, like indoors and things like that, versus keeping one that in a tent or in a cool room or a cool tent or anything like that. And then also, like, feeding the pitchers, because I know sometimes you can do that, sometimes you can kill it doing that.
Yeah, so those are some solid questions. If people want to keep them in their home, I recommend the grocery store ones, really, if you want a houseplant. They look great, and they're not. And what I mean by the grocery store ones are three in particular that are very, very popular. Nepenthes ventrata, which is a hybrid between ventricosa and alata, hence the name. Nepenthes miranda, I forget what that one is off the top of my head. And then Nepenthes St. Gaia, which St. Gaia has Cassiana in it, and it has something else in it. But they're hybrids that are very easy to grow. They're very tolerant of nearing no humidity. They're all intermediate conditions. Generally, if you're comfortable, that plant's comfortable. They hold on to a lot of pitchers, and they look nice. That's what I would give somebody who wants, like, just a house plant. You know, they like them as a house plant. I would just get one of the basic ones. They look great. They're easy to take care of. But let's say you're a little more advanced, right? You're like, I got a grow tent or a grow bin, maybe even a vivarium. I would still look into a lot of the more popular hybrids, but you can get into a couple of species too. Like Nepenthes diana is, I believe, Sibuanensis crossed with ampullaria. Definitely has ampullaria in it. Like that cross, that's a really good one. And some of just the intermediate species or tougher species too. Like Nepenthes gracilis is very tough. A lot of the Nepenthes vichii are very tough. Nepenthes ventricosa, it's a great one, hard to go wrong with. A lot of species that are used in those hybrids that I mentioned, those are great. Like the ventrata ventricosa crossed with alata. That ventricosa, dude, ventricosa, those things are bulletproof. I know, because I've put mine through the ringer and it does not care. So that's kind of what I would do, but tips and tricks for them. Plants don't become carnivorous because the conditions are great. Generally, they're bad. They're not a great place to be a plant. So these Nepenthes, they grow in areas where there's no nutrients. That's why they have to catch their own, since they're carnivorous, right? So they said, we got to take matters into our own hands if we want fertilization. So no nutrients, which also means their roots have grown and evolved to be very, very weak. They do not handle fertilization at all. They don't even handle little bits of salts in water. You should be watering them with as close to zero TDS water as you can get. So if you get that through RO distilled, however you get there, you get there. You want nothing but water in your water. You water them with tap water, you're just a time bomb for killing them. If you're from where I'm at, dude, my water's liquid rock. They would not appreciate that at all. And again, they're not great conditions. So it's also really bright, generally, where they live. There's Nepenthes, there's a ton of species, and they all fit different roles. So yes, there are some that live a little darker. But generally, it's bright, so you want high lighting, lots of water, and no nutrients in that water. That's a pretty solid recipe for success on them, really. Lots of people mess up with watering. They water with impure water. Or they'll try to keep them in too dark of conditions a lot of times, and they won't die, but they grow real slow. These are notoriously slow plants in general, and then you put them in less than ideal lighting, and they'll sit there for months without making a new leaf.
So they don't, like, lighting for them, from what I understand, is not so... It's not like they're going to instantly die if you have them in, like, the bad lighting, like some plants will. But, like, if you have pretty high light for them, like, almost not... I wouldn't say direct sun, from what I understand, but, like, pretty darn close.
Yeah, I'd say the more the merrier for light, really. They're harder to burn. You can burn them. You for sure can. I did. I burned my VGI pretty good. But it's a lot easier to not give them enough than to give them too much, especially if you're keeping in like houseplant conditions or you're keeping in a grow tent or greenhouse that's primarily keeping the more popular plants like aroids. Those are going to be where they're like, bump up the light on that bad boy. So lots of people who have them in tents with aroids and things will hang them so that way they're closer to the light in the hanging basket.
Mm-hmm.
And the Aravines is totally okay. Like Rob Cantley, he is a big player in the Nepenthes. He's an OG in the game, been around forever. All of his greenhouses are primarily hanging baskets, so no problem with that at all. Actually, speaking of Rob Cantley, this is a good point to bring us in here. He is the owner and operator of Borneo Exotics, one of the biggest Nepenthes nurseries and distributors in the world. That's called Borneo Exotics. It's based out of Sri Lanka. I will teach you about the codes. So when you are buying Nepenthes, you're going through a website or nursery, or even private sellers, they'll usually have like two or three letters. So Borneo Exotics, for instance, will be BE dash and a bunch of numbers next to it. All that means is that's the individual plant or batch of plants for them to keep track of, and it's also helpful for you to keep track of. You can look up those codes and you can see if your plant was an individual clone or if it's a batch of tissue culture plants. You can remember exactly which one it is. So that's very helpful to see and read. They're not necessarily crazy, anything like that. Mostly it's for the tissue culture labs, so they know exactly what it is. Lets you differentiate a little bit too. Like, I have one that's one plant in specific. It's a Maxima wavy leaf, and it's a selected clone. That's the only one. If you have it under that BE code, it is that exact same plant. So if you have the same numbers as I do, you're in business. We have the exact same plant. And others will be like, oh, this is a tissue culture batch. So you'll see those codes around, and that's all they mean. They're not anything ultra fancy by any means.
Okay, that's actually good to know, because I didn't know that before. Now, I will say one question, well, two questions, actually. First, When it comes to the Nepenthes and stuff most people see on the market and stuff, would you say it's mostly tissue cultures or clones, or would you say it's mostly seed grown, or like what would be the majority?
Majority of them, I don't know what I would say majority. A huge amount of them are tissue cultured. Tissue culture works a little bit differently in Nepenthes than it does in aeroid, so they tend to turn out a little better. They induce basaling, which is a way that they reproduce rather than like the aeroids where they kind of force them into this weird thing. They are just kind of expediting more natural behaviors. It tends to work better. So pretty much everything like Borneo Exotics does is tissue culture, nearly everything. Mm-hmm. Some nurseries don't have tissue culture labs, so everything they get is either a cutting or it's seed grown. I don't necessarily see a problem with either one. I actually like a lot of the tissue culture stuff because I can get select clones for a better price. Cuttings, they take, like I said, these are very, very slow plants. If you want to get cuttings of things, it takes a long time, and people who have grown these plants for 10 years aren't very keen on cutting them. I don't think that matters. Seed grown plants, there is a bit of a problem there. Nepenthes are polyploids, so they have multiple sets of chromosomes in them. They don't just have normal, they have entire genome replication. In one study I saw, I know it was on Nepenthes gracilis. I believe they had 5 entire copies of their genomes in there, which is insane. So they are very, very diverse. So if you get a seed out of a plant that makes hundreds and hundreds of seeds at a time, there's a chance it looks nothing like the parent. And that's a bit of a problem. And parents are very important in Nepenthes, because unlike most aeroids where you can just cross them with themselves, you'll see like Anthurium, whatever, Crystallinum will say X self. You cannot do that in Nepenthes. They're male and female plants. So just like with animals or anything else, you need a male and a female. So you can't cross anything with themselves. So parents matter a lot. So that's also why tissue culture comes in, because it's a little easier to control. You can pick select clones that have the traits you want and put those into tissue culture and grow those out that way.
That's actually good information there too. The other thing that I was going to ask, I meant to ask it before, was when growing them at home, I know I always see them in like peat, at least like at the stores and stuff, I always see them in like peat. Would you say it's better to grow them in peat, or like all these grocery stores do, or would you say it's better to grow them in something more like you would grow like an orchid in, like sphagnum moss, maybe some chunky like pieces of bark, or just straight spag?
Yeah, honestly, that's another hotly debated topic. Well, not hotly debated, but people want to pretend that there's a right answer and there isn't. Because like I was saying, they don't absorb any nutrients through their roots. They don't at all. They want just water. And now that they don't absorb anything, they live in very nutrient-poor environments. So it also depends on the species, right? Like we were saying, that some of them get almost freezing and some of them get 90-plus degrees. So they're different. Like Nepenthes ampullaria, I personally keep all of my Nepenthes on a mix of sphagnum moss and perlite. But if you're keeping a Nepenthes ampullaria on peat, I don't necessarily see a problem with that. I think it could be easy to overwater, but it can also be harder. Well, but it can also be closer to reality of what that plant would be in the wild. Most commonly, if it's available, would be a high-quality sphagnum moss or high-quality sphagnum moss with some perlite in there. That's the most common things you're going to see. But at the end of the day, if it's inert and can stay wet, that's what you want. And then you'll want something that holds up longer. If you use things like coconut fiber, you'll have to rinse that coconut fiber a lot. Really, really make sure it's clean. A lot of that stuff has a ton of salt in it. And it will go alkaline over time. So every year or so, you're going to have to repot your plant just based off of what it's potted in. Whereas like sphagnum moss, you technically don't ever have to repot it out of that. And you don't have to worry about your soil going bad on you. I've seen people grow in Acadama for some of the lithophytic species that want a little more rockiness to them. There's all sorts of things. I've seen people grow them just on like wood, like an epiphyte truly would be. I've seen some people grow Vichyi like that. There's some really cool pictures of Vichyi in the wild growing up trees. And I've seen people grow them like that. They've replicated that environment similar to how we would do like with a moss pole and a monstera. So that's not that's hotly debated, but again, like inert and wet, that's really what you're looking for.
Okay, so basically, like you said, inert and wet, and also it kind of depends on the species that you're looking to do, and also your watering routine. Like if you tend to be someone who waters more, do something like a sphag moss or something that dries out a little bit quicker. If you're someone who tends to underwater, do something maybe like peat that's going to hold the water a little bit longer.
Yeah, and aeration is a thing too. Like I say, a lot of these are epiphytes, so very similar to a lot of your popular aeroids. So some people keep in net pots. I have kept things in net pots before, and then I went out of town, didn't water them during that time, and net pots dry out faster, so lost those ones. But net pots are good if you're going to use something like coconut fiber that holds a little more moisture. It'll get a little more airflow to those roots. That's also why I mix in a little bit of perlite into my sphagnum moss. Just keeps it a little looser. They're not difficult to care for, but they play by different rules. So if you try to treat it as if you were keeping a monstera, you're going to have a very unhappy Nepenthes. If you keep it like a Nepenthes, in that nutrient poor, wet, bright environment, it'll do great for you. Actually, another thing, you mentioned it, but we got distracted. I'll bring us right back, is fertilization. So,
yes.
Never fertilize the roots, always fertilize the pitchers. The best fertilizers on the market, well, my opinion, there's two main ones to go with. Maxi and Osmocote. Maxi, I do like a quarter teaspoon per gallon of fertilizer. I dilute it a lot, have it very weak. I believe the recommended dosage is like 1 teaspoon per gallon of water for like tomatoes, but cut that by like a quarter. Do like a quarter teaspoon. And you can fill up the pitchers with that. Or Osmocote, just drop a couple of little pellets into each pitcher. This is something I learned recently. This is another Rob Cantley golden tidbit. Was he said there's an old wives' tale that if you keep your plants hungry, they'll make bigger pitchers. And he said in that case, the old wives were right. If you keep your plants a little hungry, they tend to make better, bigger pitchers, which is not something I've necessarily experimented with too directly yet, because I was of the mindset that if I use like positive reinforcement on my plants, they'll be excited about it. So if I keep my plants full, it'll trick the plant and be like, wow, these pitchers are really, really effective. I should make more and make bigger ones. But now I'm starting to fertilize less. So I might fertilize, like once a new pitcher pops and fully hardens off, I might fill that one up with fertilizer and then never again. That's kind of the mindset I'm taking with it now. So oddly enough, I think it's easier to over-fertilize than to under-fertilize. I think that was the case with my Nepenthes refleziana specifically. You'll see an over-fertilized plant might just keep one pitcher at a time rather than keeping 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 pitchers at a time. And I have kind of noticed that to be true. After I heard that, I went and looked at my Nepenthes gracilis, which I have not been fertilizing very good at all because it's growing in a very annoying position for me right now. It's vining everywhere but where I want it to. And so the pitchers like are really hard to reach. Yeah. So I haven't really been able to fertilize it easily. And I've noticed it has a ton of nice pitchers on it. Even though I haven't given into good solid fertilization in months, just an occasional little bit when it's convenient for me. I'm already working down there in the tent, and I just happen to be like, oh, I'll give some to you too. So I do think it's true. I mean, I don't have reason to doubt a guy who's been doing it since the 70s. So I do believe that's the case. But yeah, some people want to get excited and feed them like bugs and stuff, which I've done before. I've had extra mealworms on hand, and I've dropped those into the pitchers, but I don't think that's necessary.
I feel like from my, like, I guess an outside perspective with like the pitchers, it makes sense that less fertilization causes them to grow larger pitchers. Because like, if you think about it, it's like, I mean, just straight up like evolution, the larger pitchers have a better chance of catching a bug. So like the less you fertilize the smaller ones, because when you're like fertilizing the smaller ones, you're like, oh, I'm getting my food. Why would I go bigger and waste energy? Versus when you're not giving them that food or that energy, then they're going to grow bigger and bigger pitchers, because then it's more likely for it to attract a bug or fly or whatever in the wild for them to be able to catch them.
Yeah, and it seems like that was more the case rather than reinforcing the being like, yeah, look how good these pitchers are doing, you should make more kind of philosophy. But yeah, doesn't mean you shouldn't fertilize at all. You should fertilize for sure. Just don't necessarily keep every single pitcher you see 100% full of fertilizer all the time. And then it kind of makes sense as well with some of the species like Nepenthes ampullaria, that's actually a vegetarian. Nepenthes ampullaria grows on the bottom of trees where dead leaves will fall. It doesn't have a lid like most other ones. It has its lid kind of faces away and keeps those pitchers open. So if it makes a bigger net, essentially, it makes those carpeting pitchers, makes bigger pitchers, it's more likely to have a leaf fall in there. And then you think about it, leaves, dead leaves really don't have that much energy in them. The plant, the reason they're all crispy is because the tree sucked all the nutrients out of it and diverted it to other areas of the plant. So pretty nutrient poor, and that's what this thing's living off of. So if you give it a ton of fertilizer, it's not very natural for it.
Yeah. That, I mean, the way I think of it with that is, like I was saying, that having the better chance to catch more food, because if they're getting what they want with the smaller pitchers, why would they waste the energy to make a bigger one? Because it's going to take a lot of energy to make that big picture. But if the little one's working so well, what would be the point of making a bigger one that's going to work probably just as well and waste all that energy? At least that's my thought process behind it.
Yeah, and I don't think anyone truly knows exactly why at this point. But it also, another thing too, is if you fertilize a lot, that pitcher is going to die faster. And sometimes you're okay with sacrificing some smaller ones to get bigger ones in the future. But they are just leaves. The pitchers are just modified leaves. They're a fancy leaf with a cool lip on it called a peristome, and they got this waxy coating in there that sticks to bugs' feet, so now they're slippery and can't move. But it, at the end of the day, it's just a leaf. And leaves, as we all know, keeping plants, they don't last forever, right? They're alive, and anything that's alive dies. And it puts a lot of strain on plants to be pushing digestive enzymes and doing all this work. It takes a long time. And Nepenthes specifically will fill up, right? You put a bunch of bugs in there, now it's full. It can't catch anymore. So there's a bunch of fertilizer, it's going to be like, oh, I'm full of nutrients, I need to kill this pitcher so that way I can make room for a new one because this one's probably full. And the way Nepenthes die is actually really cool when they intentionally kill their pitchers. They die from the top down. So the peristome is the first thing that dies, so it quits attracting bugs and everything. And now those bugs will be bugs, tree shrews, whatever it is that they're trying to attract, will go to other pitchers that are still have that nice, bright, pretty peristome on them, and then they die from the top down. And that also allows for the digestive enzymes to stay alive, not alive, but to stay functional in the bottom of the pitcher, and make sure it absorbs everything that's currently in the pitcher before it dies, and so nothing's wasted.
Now, I will, one thing I wanted to ask, because, like, I know why, or I know the difference, but someone first getting into Nepenthes and things like, and carnivorous plants in general might not. So, well, two things, actually. First, I'm going to start off with, we're talking about the food and things like that. So I know, like, Venus flytraps, if they catch one bug, that flytrap will then die after it digests the bug. Nepenthes, they will catch lots of bugs and basically until they're full and then die, correct?
Yeah, and it depends too. Like, I've seen pictures of Nepenthes lowii completely full of tree shrew poop. Like, it looks like completely 100% full and the plant's still alive.
Mm-hmm.
So they will die over time. Like, it just is. They don't have a set time limit like fly traps. It's like three, something like, it's like five total closes and like three crew captures, they die. But yeah, kind of same thing. Like, they don't have a set of a timer because they don't move. And okay. Speaking of that, that's actually a solid segue into one of my favorite quotes of all time. Well, there's two. They're old-timey quotes from people who just discovered Nepenthes. They're great. I found them on Wikipedia, which is hilarious that they're on there. Shout out to whoever put those on. So this one is, this urn is hollow, as I've just said, usually full of soft, clear water, then closed. It opens during the day, and more than half the liquid disappears. But this loss is repaired during the night, and the next day the urn is full again and closed by its lid. This is its substance and enough for more than one day, because it is always about half full at the approach of night, as translated from French, so it's not 100%, by John Baptist Lamarack. Now, that's hilarious, and Alex isn't even a Nepenthes expert here, but I know he finds it the same. Like, what is this guy talking about?
Yeah.
Because Nepenthes do not move. They don't open or close, and they're never 100% full. Unless you fill them up. So, what happened? I don't remember what year this quote came from, but it's hilarious. So, he almost has a point, though. Talking about the liquid being the substance for the plant, that is actually true to an extent. It's not necessarily the liquid, it's what's in the liquid. But what he's getting at here is, he saw a plant, in my diagnosis of this, is he saw a plant out in the jungle, and he saw pitchers that hadn't popped yet, or opened. They call it popping because they kind of do it in quick movement, and they're still sealed. And if you shine a light or look through the sun at these, they will have some water in them because the plant creates, you know, its own juice in there. And so it actually kind of makes sense that he's like, oh, they must close at night to keep everything inside and then open. But they don't do that. So he clearly didn't even spend a day with this plant. Like, right now, my grow tent light is off. If I was to go in there, all of my pitchers would still be open. Unless they were closed already. So, that's hilarious that they do think that. But he almost has a point. Like, he's almost there. Almost got it figured out. But this is my actual... Oh, yeah. No, one more question.
Sorry, the other thing that I want, because I know a lot of people will hung up on this too. So people who are just getting into the Nepenthes and pitcher plants, I know the differences and stuff because I've kept the alternative, but Sarsinia versus Nepenthes, because they're both technically pitcher plants, but they basically are completely different.
Yeah. The few things they share are they like nutrient-poor environments,
uh-huh.
They like a lot of water, they like bright light, and they use a pitfall-style trap. That's also true for Heliumphora and Cephalotus, two forgotten pitcher plant species. Everyone always mm-hmm. forgets those guys. But that's about where they stop. That's about it. Everything else there, that's different. Sarsinia from the Americas, specifically the United States and Canada. I don't believe there's any in Mexico. I'd be surprised if there was. I believe it's just the United States and Canada that have them.
could be wrong, but I think the majority of Sarracenia actually come from my area in the U.S., the southeastern area.
Yeah. Yeah, that is true. Surprising amounts in Canada, though. Yeah, surprising amounts in Canada. But, yeah, the American southeast specifically is your hot spot for them. They are terrestrial. They grow on peat bogs or sphagnum bogs, whatever you guys call them over there, just big swampy areas. That's where they grow. Nepenthes, they grow up in the jungles. They're climbing plants and vines. Sarracenia are just standalone pitchers. They might call them trumpet pitchers, something like that.
Yeah, they grow via rhizomes.
Yeah, so they're very similar. What I would compare them to would be Heliumphora. Sarracenia are much more similar to Heliumphora, which are a South American pitcher plant that grow on tepuis. They're big, flat mountains up there. They get tons and tons of rain. There's actually a species of Heliumphora called Heliumphora sarracenoides. And if you watched our episode on Latin, you would know that means Sarracenia-like Heliumphora. So they're very, very similar. They function a lot more closely. And Cephalotis, they're weird. They do their own thing. They're weird little dudes. But yeah, so we'll do my last favorite quote here. It is one of my favorite old-timey science quotes. I love old-timey science because you could just make stuff up and people would believe it and be like, oh, wow, yes. Yes, very smart. And the mindset was very different, and you'll see what I mean. So this one starts off here. This is another one that's been translated from Latin, and it was via John Ray. So John Ray said this guy said this, and said, yeah, it's Hermann Nicholas Grimm. The root draws up moisture from the earth, which with the help of the sun's rays rises up into the plant itself, then flows down through the stems and nerves of the leaves into the natural utensil to be stored there until used for human needs. So this guy, this specific one is from Madagascar. The specific plant he was talking about was Nepenthes madagascarensis. So Nepenthes from Madagascar. It's actually on their money. Very cool. Again, he's right. He is right to an extent. The roots do draw up moisture, and the sun gives them the energy to utilize xylem and phloem and move that water around, and they do put water into the natural utensil, which would be the pitcher. And he's right. And it is stored there. But here's my favorite part. For human needs. So this guy goes to Madagascar, middle of the jungle. To his knowledge, nobody has ever seen this before. Is just waiting for him to use this mystery juice. For people specifically. Like, what is that? Like, who? Thinking like that is crazy to me. Like, it's just such a different time than now. Like, they thought that this, everything was made for humans.
Oh, yeah.
Very, very interesting to me. Like, I love that old, reading through that old-timey science where it's just different. Just wandering out into the jungle and being like, you know what? This is for me. This is for human purposes.
Yep.
Like, that's, man, I love that one. That's my favorite. One of my favorite quotes of all time. Just all of it. But yeah, any final notes? Or questions?
I don't have any off the top of my head. I think we hit pretty much the majority of like good ones for people just getting into the Nepenthes.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to claim to be a Nepenthes expert at all. I claim to be in not the Hall of Fame, but the Hall of Pretty Okay. I know a lot of the basics, for sure. I know a good bit about a few individual things, but I'm definitely not one of the big heavy hitters. Like I said, I would like to have a more in-depth episode with probably two different guests on here to just have it be nearing debate style or talk about this and that and get very in-depth on it and be able to bounce some ideas off. Because they're very interesting. They're very debated a lot. They're very weird and unique. So there's a lot of things that people don't know about. And they're very threatened, just the areas of the world they live in. Like, for instance, Nepenthes vicii, one of the main ones we use as an example, it's an epiphyte, so it grows on the trees. And as the rainforests get cut down, anything that lived on the trees also dies. So we're losing more and more species and locations of these species every day. There's a lot of very limited ranges. A lot of these plants only live on one mountain. For instance, there's a Cassiana location, one that I'm really trying to get my hands on, not because of this, but I want to have another one in cultivation so we don't lose it forever, that was taken out by a mine. It was from India, and a mine was put in, and it destroyed the mountain, the only mountain where this form of this plant was from. And so they don't exist anymore in the wild, and can't ever be brought back because their habitat is literally gone. It doesn't exist. They completely uprooted the only place in the world this plant lived.
Yeah, which is horrible and happens a lot more than it should. I mean, it's another good example, I mean, not for Nepenthes, but another good example of a species that is a carnivorous species that is only found in a small area is Venus flytraps. The only natural populations of them are found within 100 miles of Wilmington, North Carolina.
Yeah, and so it makes studying them very hard as well, because not only is there that, where they have very small ranges, so they can just disappear, there are also some that are in, like, politically, some, like, political turmoil and stuff over there. So, for instance, Nepenthes clausii, an expedition was sent out to go find them, and the people got kidnapped by the locals and held for ransom. So there's lots of political unrest and things going on. It was not a safe place to be. And so we can't really go see clausii anymore. So I believe only two people have ever been able to study that plant in situ or in the wild ever. So there's a ton to learn, and there's lots of other very similar examples. That was just one that was off the top of my head.
That reminds me of a lot of the, like, African aroid species, too, like from the Congo and stuff. They're just really hard to find. And
unfortunately, a common problem is a bunch of humans who can't get along, you know, interrupting science. Yeah, it's very hard. But yeah, the Nepenthes, those intro to Nepenthes, I hope that covered everything for the most part. If you have any other questions, drop them in the comments. We'll get back to you on them for sure. Or anything we missed, anything that we didn't say that you think is important to say, or fun facts, anything. There's so much to talk about with Nepenthes. No way we could get it all done in one 45-minute-ish episode. So leave it in the comments and like, comment, subscribe, do all the good stuff. And we will see you on the next one.
See you guys.